Radio City, back at it once again. John Grayson and Rob Ross, because you can't keep either one of us away from a microphone. Rob, how's everything going?
It's going well, although I'm a little bit sore. We had our office beach day on Thursday, and I was out in the sun a little too long, and so I'm in that process of healing and peeling, thanks to the miracle known as aloe vera lotion.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, load up on that stuff.
For the first time in a long time, I can actually say I got some color. And I got to tell you, I forgot how wonderfully relaxing a day at the beach can be. I mean, the last time I was there was in Cocoa Beach back in 1996, when you truly understood what the word vacation meant.
Right.
To vacate completely for a week. This was just a day spent down at Sandy Hook Beach in New Jersey, which is absolutely beautiful and quiet and remote. It's the very start of the Jersey Shore. The northernmost point of the Jersey Shore, and had such a great time. Imbibed no alcohol whatsoever with my my work colleagues, but spent a lot of time in the water, alternating between the water and the beach itself, and just enjoying the conversations. And we did in fact see a shark, a little one. It was a baby, albeit, but it came up on the beach twice. And this fellow who's there with his family actually caught it on both occasions. Took it out of the water, held it up, brought it back out, came back again, grabbed it again. This time he took it out further so he could, you know, swim out to sea. And I thought, that's pretty gutsy. He's a hero to his kids, that's for sure.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny because I used to see guys doing that every so often when I used to spend a lot of time at the Delaware Shore. And there was, in fact, a shark attack just a couple of days ago in New Jersey, the first time that one of those had occurred, I think they said, in 5 or 6 years. So, but it wasn't, I mean, whoever it was survived and life was good there. But I used to see these guys all the time doing the shore fishing routine where you stand. Sometimes they stand on shore and sometimes they'll stand in about 3 or 4 feet of water, just, you know, up to their waist. And I saw a guy out there one time. I asked him, what are you fishing for? And he said, sharks. And I thought, are you out of your skull? You're standing in the water fishing for sharks. What's the matter with you?
All I can tell you is this. It was surprising. It was interesting. It wasn't frightening. But all in all, it was just a really, really sorely needed day away from the office. Just to be out by the water, which is always remarkably therapeutic for me.
Yeah.
Always. And I was exhausted by the time I got home. I mean, I had a really nice, relaxing drive home. You know, it was quick, so there was no traffic, and that felt really good. But I was sitting on the couch for all of 15, 20 minutes and started to nod off on various occasions. But needless to say, it was an early night, but yeah, I definitely needed that, and it felt really good. And speaking of feeling really good, a carryover from last week when we reported that from my hometown of Staten Island, the Mid-Island League Little League Baseball team has in fact made it all the way to the finale, the championship game of the Little League World Series in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, by beating Texas today. So that game will be played, I believe it's either Tuesday or Wednesday night, and it's going to be on ESPN in prime time. So once again, hats off to the kids for an absolutely terrific season. I mean, they have been – it turns out their record has been perfect all season, all summer long, no losses. So that's one for the record books.
That's incredible. And what a great story. You know, again, you can't help but feel good for them. Do we know who their opponent is going to be?
Not yet.
Okay.
I believe that game is being played tomorrow, or it was played this afternoon. See, the thing is, they're not very good about showing the upcoming rounds and who's playing whom. I saw the bracket for a millisecond, and I think it might be one of the choices may have been a team from California, but I really can't be sure.
Okay.
Because they're Mid-Island and New York comes from the, quote, Mid-Atlantic division. So let us see and let us keep our fingers crossed. Like I said last week, the fact that they got this far is more than, you know, ample reason for us to be happy for them and to celebrate them and to laud them. But the fact that they've gotten to this point, as I said last week, in my mind, they've already won. They've achieved more than anybody even hoped or thought they could.
Right.
And it's great. It's great for them. It's great for the people of Staten Island who – I feel as a community, we deserve this kind of good news on a national level, another feel-good story, if you will. And I'm hoping for the best. And they play with such fire and such spirit that I believe that they could win. And
good
I
deal.
Will hope they do.
Well, let me commend you, by the way, on making the decision while you were off on vacation not to get drunk around your coworkers.
There are
way too many people make that mistake because, you know, these are people that we see all the time. We feel comfortable with them. And I can't say I've never done it. I've never, you know, had drinks with my coworkers at Christmas parties and things like that, but never have I allowed myself to get out of control drunk. I don't do that very much anyway. I mean, I can count on one hand in my life the times when it's gone that far, and it's certainly never around the people that I work with. I never understood the people who just get sloppy in front of people who make decisions about their money.
Well, I'll tell you something. There's a couple of things to say about that for Thursday. And like you, A, I don't drink on a general basis. If I do, I'll have a couple of glasses of wine at City Winery or at a dinner. That's it.
Right.
You know, if I have to drive, there's no way I'm drinking alcohol, period. Drinking in that kind of heat is dangerous.
Yes, it is.
You know, and I don't want to feel ill. That's another thing. Now, the thing about my coworkers, and they're all very nice people. I'm only just getting to know them since I've only been there since January, but they started drinking before they even arrived at the beach. From what I understood, most of them had taken the ferry that goes from Manhattan to Sandy Hook, and they began drinking at the bar on the ferry.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about 10, 11 o'clock in the morning, and I really don't recall seeing too many people without a can or a cup in their hands the entire afternoon. So we were there from about, I'd say, 10:30 till 5:15. And some of them were getting to the point of being a little incoherent. There were no incidents. There were no inappropriate moments as far as I was able to see. But the other thing is also I'm older than they are. So in a lot of ways, in my mind, lead by example.
Right.
I was there to have a good time at the water, enjoy the day, enjoy the fresh air, you know, and that was my MO, period. So as far as the days of drinking to the point of being out of control at Christmas parties, that's another story entirely. Because my first Atlantic Records Christmas was a Warner Music Group Christmas party that had all the labels. It was, you know, Warner, Elektra, Atlantic. And some of the subdivisions. It was held at Roseland Ballroom in Manhattan. And it was open bar, and there were three bars located throughout the venue.
Yeah.
And all I can tell you is I don't know to this day the name of that blonde girl that I was with backstage and how she was able to figure out how to get to that certain place backstage, but I'll leave the rest unmentioned. It would be gentlemanly of me.
Well, I'll tell you.
Life in another, you know, in another time, another space.
One of the things that actually is becoming more and more popular now, and it's weird to be talking about this in August, but for the Christmas parties, is to have them on a Thursday or a Wednesday so that people have to work the next day. You know what I mean? So they figure, I guess, if you have to show up at work the next day, you're not going to get totally plowed the night before. But the Friday night or Saturday night Christmas parties are rapidly becoming a thing of the past.
I have never, to the best of my recollection, ever been to a Friday Christmas party.
Yeah.
They've always been midweek. Thursday, I think, is the one that people prefer because most of them will take Friday off to recover.
Sure. Yeah, if you can plan it out that way, it's not a bad deal. But
right.
it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I got people that if I want to have a couple of drinks or a couple of more drinks that I can drink around and it's not going to have any consequences to it. So life is good. But yeah, on the subject of life being good, by the way, boy, did we see a great concert this week. And this is, you know, way back in probably 1993 or 94, I used to get pitches all the time from Alligator Records, and Alligator Records was largely at that point a blues label, but they would do interesting stuff in a bunch of different genres. And I remember they sent me a pitch one time, and I was happy enough with just the name of the band that I said, you know what, I've got to book these guys. I got to get them on my afternoon show, because it was a band called Sapphire, the Uppity Blues Women. And I thought, you know what, with a name like that, how could I not put them on the radio? So we did. And not only was the music great, and it was at that point, it was a four piece. And the music was great and it was funny and it was, you know, it had some edge to it, but it wasn't edgy. You know, it was just, and these women did not get together and start playing as a band until they were all in their 50s. So all of a sudden they just thought, okay, here we are. We all are historians with this music. We know the music. Why don't we just start playing together? And they did. And it was great. And it was a lot of fun. Well, one of their founding members died 5 years ago, and they had already decided once they were in their late 60s to kind of retire and hang it up. And just within the last couple of months, they decided to put together something called Sapphire Revisited, and it's two of the original members and a keyboard player by the name of Kelly Hunt, who has a career of her own playing blues piano and goes out and does the festival circuit and all of that. And they put together Sapphire Revisited, had them on the air again Friday, and went to see the show Saturday night. And it was, I mean, for a bunch of women, well, three of them, two of whom are in their 70s now, and one who is probably between 50 and 55, to see them on stage and just having a blast playing this music. It was so much fun, and the audience loved it. Absolutely loved it. They could have played for 3 hours.
I remember when they used to play in New York fairly regularly.
Yep.
And then they just disappeared.
Yeah.
And well, interesting. But then again, you know, that goes right into the theory of, and people love to argue because nowadays people will argue everything. The idea of older performers coming back after retiring or whatever, or old bands getting back together again. A lot of people are on the side of, oh, they're just doing it to make a buck. First of all, okay, that's fine. Why not?
You know? Right, sure.
You can go out and play music that people love and remember and revere, and they want to see you do it, and they're willing to pay, then why not? What is the problem with that?
Yep.
You were paying to see them when they were younger and on the way down, certainly. And, of course, there are those that are of the mindset of, hey, you know what? Sometimes it's the older folks who can show the younger ones how to do it right.
Right.
Which is kind of the way I view it now. Perfect example of the bands that I've seen over the last 4 or 5 years, the Eagles, Fleetwood Mac, Stevie Nicks solo, you know, the Pretenders, God rest his soul, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Steve Winwood, you know, even Paul Weller and Bob Mould, you know, they still know how to go out and do this.
Right.
And do it right. Or even seeing the DBs get back together and still play with the same kind of emotional intensity that I remember them having in the early 80s, except the added bonus of the joy that you didn't get back then. And I'm not saying that in a negative sense. It's the joy that's coming from the band themselves to be back together and playing for the audience is very obviously conveyed.
Right.
You know, I'm all for that.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And they were just, you know, if this is a very small theater. I mean, the Wildy Theater in Edwardsville seats between 250 and 300 people. And so if they're doing it for the money, they're doing the wrong thing. You know, I'm sure they got paid very well for the night, but they're not out there making thousands of dollars a gig. If they make hundreds of dollars a gig, it's probably a lot. So they're just out there doing it because they love to do it. But you know what? Like you just said, on stage, I'll take that. That comes across.
Right. And that you can't put a price on that.
Right.
Because, you know, especially having grown up in the punk era, joy was not something that was supposed to be offered back to the audience.
Yep.
Provocation, maybe, if you wanted to be intellectual and be, you know, given food for thought, okay. But fun was not part of the prerequisite.
Yep. And on the unfortunate side of things, when last we spoke, we mentioned the fact that we kind of knew that, you know, when they start throwing around the word hospice, it usually means that somebody's life is just about over. And that was the case the last time we spoke with Aretha Franklin. And she did indeed. She died earlier this week. And it was, I mean, the outpouring from everybody was exactly what you would expect because of a life that just changed music. And she was incredible. She was just a force. There's very little that I think either one of us can add to what's already been said about Aretha Franklin other than, yeah, when the news finally did come down, expected as it may have been, but on Thursday, it didn't make any difference. Exactly. On Thursday, when we heard it, it was still that sinking feeling in your heart.
that was the one thing that marred my day at the beach, because I was laying on the sand, and that's when I got the breaking news flash on my phone that she had passed. And, you know, it just the ride home, every other station had their tributes and so on and so forth. The irony being that the Queen of Soul died the day the King of Rock and Roll had also died.
Right.
Because it was the anniversary of Elvis Presley's passing.
Yep.
But yeah, it's, you know, it's a loss. But as you and I have discussed so many times, especially because we're older, it doesn't get any easier knowing that our heroes of a generation when music really meant something, something of merit, something of value, something in a social context, when they pass, it doesn't make it any easier. You know, we're looking at people like Paul McCartney and Pete Townsend who are in their 70s, you know?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think tomorrow Robert Plant turns 70 years old.
Unbelievable, yeah. You know? Mick and Keith, you know, well, Keith Richards is an exception because he's going to outlive all of us, obviously. Right. And as the joke goes, you know, we have to start preparing the world to leave it for him.
Yep.
So.
Well, yeah, and they had a picture of, I guess, he's got a bunch of daughters who are all in their 30s.
Yep.
And they say, you know, when they pass away, he's going to inherit everything.
Exactly. You know, he married a girl from Staten Island.
Oh, did he really?
Yes, he did. Patty Hansen is indeed from Staten Island, New York. So.
How about that?
She's one of ours.
But yeah, with Aretha, the one great thing that really came out of that, and I had seen it during the broadcast when it aired the first time, but when they started replaying the Kennedy Center Honors, when she was tributing Carole King, who was up there, and that was the greatest part about that is, I mean, certainly the performance of Natural Woman was fantastic because, well, it's Aretha Franklin, for crying out loud. But when you saw Carole up there in the booth and she's just egging her on, and you could see the joy in her face from hearing a song that she wrote coming back to her out of the mouth of Aretha Franklin. I mean, I got chills watching it every time, and I must've seen it 20 times on Thursday and Friday.
You know, what's funny is that, the one thing that irritated me, because people don't do a good enough job in their job. And I'm talking about the media. You know, they can't be bothered to fact check even the most obvious things in the world. never mind the Fox debacle, which I don't even know if we should get into it, because I don't even think we should waste our breath on how appalling that was.
Yeah.
And how just morally disrespectful it was.
Right.
People going on about the song Respect. Now, I have to take a little bit of umbrage here. I know it was Aretha's version that was the big hit, and it's the, you know, the known version, if you will, worldwide, but she didn't write it.
No.
How stupidly irresponsible can you be to say, you know, and, you know, she wrote Respect about, you know, no, she did not write Respect. She did not originate Respect. It was written by Otis Redding.
Yep.
And it was about the whole civil rights movement. It wasn't about male-female relations.
What you want, what have you got it? What you need, baby, you got it. All I'm asking for a little respect when I come home.
He spun it a little differently when you heard his version than the way she delivered it. She
right.
made it her own. There's no question about it. But the fact is, the context in which Otis Redding wrote and performed it is a world away from Aretha Franklin's performance. Pure and simple. Do your homework, people. It isn't that hard to get the answers correct.
Right.
Because they're all there and available for you.
Yeah, and it's laziness, and that's the thing that really bothers me the most about it, is that, you know, the print media, the electronic media decided a long time ago that they were going to stop paying people what they were worth. So those same people now teach in colleges, and the people who are doing the job are such lazy asses that they figure, oh, well, I'll look it up on Wikipedia and put whatever I find up on the page and everything will be fine. Or do a Google image search on Aretha Franklin and come up with Patti LaBelle, like you were referring to. It's just flat laziness. And, you know, I don't expect somebody who's 20 years old to be able to necessarily look at a picture of Aretha Franklin and recognize her, or recognize one that isn't. But still, you've got to be able to do the job well enough. And if you can't, go do something else.
Exactly. And let's face it, you know, It could have been Patti LaBelle or it could have been On Esther.
Yes. Oh, so sad.
But you know, it is. It's interesting now that August 16th will be split between those two passings because they are such momentous passings. I mean, Elvis is Elvis. And you can make the case that no matter how you slice it, August 16th will always be remembered as the day that the king died.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's just it. But it's still, it's a loss. It really is. So, you know, it's all part of life's rich pageant. Oh, and speaking of which, you want to talk about sloppy journalism. There is some song by some singer. I think it's that Nicki Minaj woman.
Okay.
I don't know if you saw any of this on any of your news feeds, but she has a song on her latest album called R.E.M., which has nothing to do with the band. Idiots out there immediately thought that she did a song about the band and thought that they were getting back together again.
Why? How do people get this shit in their brains?
This gets even worse.
Okay. So
NME, who are masters of suckage, but then again, it's the British press, so are you surprised?
Yeah.
Refer to them in this article about this song and this, you know, this mix-up as the Michael Stipe Band.
As though that was their name?
I don't know if it was meant in that sense, because if that was the case, then I would have thought, and again, hear me out because of my grammatical correctness leanings, they would have capitalized the B in band and the T in the.
Oh, okay, right,
but,
right.
You know, but the Michael Stipe Band had gotten back together.
like he was the only one worth mentioning in that band.
You know, I would probably think, and maybe it's just me, but I think Mike Mills and Peter Buck and Bill Berry would probably take a little bit of umbrage with this. I don't know.
Yeah.
Not with him, but with them for being so unbelievably callous, you
right,
know?
Right. Oh,
but there you go. Once again, it's sloppy journalism. But like you just said, if you can't do it, go do something else, like being a publicist, because we all know how good they are.
Yeah. Oh, I know. And I'll tell you, even though he was a very nice guy and did a pretty decent job going back to the Sapphire thing, when I got word about them coming to town, I had to go chase them down and, you know, didn't find much of a website or any kind of presence at all. And that sort of dropping the ball with a social media presence for a band is, again, how do you do that? It's unforgivable.
Do they have a publicist proper, or are they doing this all themselves?
They have a guy who is on the road with them. He's sort of a tour manager who's taking on those duties. But yeah, nothing much to speak of, and it should be a much bigger deal than it is. So
it's very simple. Even if you're a tour manager and you don't have a, quote, formal publicist, your responsibility is to get in touch with the people in the local media that you've already been in contact with.
Right.
Outlets where you know that your performers are going to be either interviewed, photographed, written about. And you confirm everything and make sure that everything is running like clockwork.
Yep.
It's not difficult. Pick up the phone or answer your emails.
Exactly. And it doesn't cost you anything to do it. So, you know, if it makes your band more money, it makes you more money. You'd think that people would grab onto that.
Well, remember, yeah, that's a lofty thought. The desire for people to actually do their jobs. Come on, man. What year are we living in now?
True enough. Now, I got to flip tracks here for just a second and ask a question that I honestly do not know the answer to because I've been so wrapped up in following the continuing drama of my Buffalo Bills. But now that we're into the second week, or the second week of preseason, I guess, is mostly done, is there anything going on with either of the New York teams that's worth mentioning at this point?
Well, the Giants are still definitely stumbling over their own feet. The Jets lost by 2 points to Washington the other night. But the Jets are holding their own so far.
Yeah.
So I don't have any complaints. I don't see anything that I should already be pressing the panic button over. We're also starting to gear up now, God help me, even though we're in the middle of August, towards the hockey season, because all of a sudden you're seeing a lot of ads for the Rangers and a lot of social media presence. It's a team that's in a state of complete rebuilding. So my thing is right now, the Mets have been – surprisingly entertaining these last 2 weeks. We talked about, I believe it was the last show, or maybe the one prior to it, where I walked into a store and saw the Mets being beaten at that moment 10-0, and they wound up losing that game 25-4. Well, I came home from the beach on Thursday and saw that the Mets had beaten the Phillies 24-5.
Right. So they got one back that was a double digit win.
Yeah, that was the first time in their history that they had done that, when the night before they had beaten the Orioles 16-5.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, the drubbing that they gave the Orioles was kind of a shock because they were down initially in the game. But, and then, to mention the fact that they beat the Yankees last weekend, at the end of last weekend. It was a makeup day for a rained out game previously. And last night, Jacob DeGrom pitched a complete game, which is a rarity in this day and age in baseball, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
Masterful pitching, 3-1 over the Phillies. So they've got the series right now because they played a 5-game series with the Phillies, culminating tonight in Williamsport. They're playing the second annual Little League Trophy game. I think that's what it's called. And it's really nice that it's the Phillies and the Mets. And they had both teams there at the game that Mid-Island won earlier in the day to root on the kids in general, which was, I think, terrific. They had them there in the booth. Jake Arrieta of the Phillies was absolutely terrific with the kids from Mid-Island because he was talking to them on air. I tip my hat to him. That's what it's supposed to be about. You have the actual major league players being ambassadors for the game.
Right.
And that's a really good thing to see because you forget that still can exist in major league sports.
Yeah, exactly. And meanwhile, back to football for, well, actually, before we get back to football, in the middle of all of this, the St. Louis Cardinals out of nowhere are on fire. And Matt Carpenter's had a lot to do with that. But I mean, a team that even the Cardinal faithful had all but given up on when Mike Matheny lost his job just a few weeks ago, is all of a sudden in playoff contention. I mean, these guys are, I think the last I saw, they were a game out of the second wild card spot, and they were maybe 4 games back of Chicago for the division lead. So there's plenty of time left. These guys, I think they're 9 of their last 10. And in baseball, everybody knows what an incredibly difficult run that is to put together. But if they keep this level of play up, they could easily find themselves in the postseason again. And that's just, given where they were, that's incredible.
Well, it's funny. By the way, I just want to report right now, as it stands, it's the Mets 4-0 over the Phillies.
Nice. Well done.
And I'm happy to say, because I did catch a glimpse of the game before you and I went on the air, that for the first time they're finally wearing an orange and blue cap. So maybe they're getting it. A road cap that's orange is a good idea. It's a great look.
Yeah.
Anyway, the other one I wanted to bring up is the phenomenal rise, and I mean rise, of the Oakland A's, who have stormed their way into first place in the American League West to tie themselves with the runaway train known as the Houston Astros.
Yeah.
Now that, I don't think anybody saw that coming by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
But as of right now, unfortunately, it is Houston back in first place by 1 game because they played each other over the weekend and Houston managed to salvage this one. They almost got swept.
Right. Well, and I was going to say, that may actually turn out to be a good thing for Houston even before this series happened, because I think they needed somebody nipping at their heels, given the fact that they were, again, like you said, a runaway train. And, and after last year, we were talking about this right after the World Series, whether they would be able to parlay that into a decent start of the 2018 season. And they did, but I think that they were getting a little complacent. So maybe having Oakland back there really is going to light a fire under them again.
Well, the thing that Houston didn't do this year was they didn't make a trade for a big-name player. Last year at the trade deadline, they got Justin Verlander, who, in fact, was the icing on the cake.
Right.
Well, they got the same team, basically, from last year. So they didn't mess with the chemistry that made it work. And that's great for them. But, yeah, you're right. Having Oakland come in and just do what they've done, it's phenomenal. I mean, the only other team that's unstoppable are the Red Sox. I mean, the Red Sox are just – the Yankees at this point I don't think are going to make the playoffs. Not that I care or would weep for that because of my obvious lifelong hatred of the New York Yankees. But, I mean, the fact is the Red Sox record is an absolute light year away from Houston's record because the Red Sox already have 88 wins. So, that's a team that's – if Houston and Oakland are good, the Red Sox are magnificent.
Right. Yeah, and with the Yankees, with me, it's not so much a hatred of the team as it is just a hatred of Hal Steinbrenner because he was such a dick in eighth grade. So,
it's not even so much the hatred of the team. I think I hate their fans more than anything because you know, they're the ones that always do that whole, they've lost two games. They're going to lose the rest of the season. Fire the manager.
Yep.
They win five games. It's like, we're going to win another World Series. That's 28 World Series. Shut up.
Yeah, enough. Enough already. Just enjoy the ride.
You can never say to a Yankees fan, hey, remember the collapse of 2004?
No, but it's so much fun. But with football, yeah, I heard something interesting toward the end of last week. We have a couple of schools here in town in the St. Louis area that have football is not a big deal when it comes to college. The only college around here that's got any kind of draw whatsoever is Mizzou, and Columbia is a good 2-hour drive from here. So the St. Louis schools have teams, but I heard, and I think it was St. Louis University, which is the school run by the Jesuits, that they were having trouble fielding a team because they just weren't getting enough people signing up to play or trying out for the team because of concussion fears. And I think that, you extrapolate this across the country, and even though we're talking about much smaller programs, this is not, Division 1A by any means, but you extrapolate that across the country and you say, okay, what's the NFL going to look like 10 years from now? And if this kind of thing keeps up, if they don't really figure out something to keep these people safe while they're playing the game, they're going to see a major, major drop-off in talent. And a major drop-off in talent means they're going to see a major drop-off in fans.
See, it's hard for me to really speak knowledgeably about it simply because, A, I follow a team that is forever mired in some kind of ineptitude.
Yeah.
I hate to say it, but it's a fact. There have been sporadic moments over the last 20 years, and I'm sorry that I'm actually saying 20 years, where the Jets have been outstanding, but I don't see that much great talent in college football anymore.
No.
Every time, and maybe it's just me, I'm sure people have spoken about it, but again, I don't follow football enough to be able to have that proper conversation. But you see some of these quarterbacks in college football, like Danny Werfel or Tim Tebow, I already can't remember the fella's name. The kid who was the Heisman winner a couple of years ago and was drafted by the Phoenix Cardinals. Or somebody like, what's his name? Johnny Manziel? Is that the
right,
kid who
right.
was drafted by Cleveland?
Cleveland, yeah, and turned into nothing.
Right. All of these phenomenal college quarterbacks don't amount to anything in the NFL. Danny Werfel never managed to go anywhere with the Saints. Tim Tebow, who's a very nice guy, is playing baseball for the Mets in the minor leagues.
Yeah. And how many guys, and Tebow says he's going to try to make another comeback, but I doubt it. And how many guys do you see, again, going back that far or farther? Wasn't Gino Toretta for about 15 minutes a member of the New York Giants? And these are all Heisman Trophy winning quarterbacks.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't. I never understood it. But, it's funny. There's a mentality behind hardcore football aficionados that they can analyze it where I can't.
Right.
But then again, I can analyze baseball and I can analyze hockey in a way that, diehard football fans. So it's not, compare and contrast. It's just a case of all of what I see.
Yeah.
And so if I watch the Jets, I don't worry about who they draft unless it's something that's so obvious. Like what do the Jets need to address first and foremost? They need, because they've had no luck with a consistent quarterback, they do need one.
Yep.
Don't think for a second you're going to draft Joe Namath again. It's not going to happen. Players like that don't exist anymore. You're not going to get another Ken O'Brien, for God's sakes. And so on and so forth. The last time the Jets had any validity, they had Vinny Testaverde at quarterback, and he was at the tail end of his career.
And it was a horrible career too. He was terrible in Tampa, terrible.
And he played his best football. Now notice he was a great college player, but he was a lousy NFL quarterback.
Yep.
But he played his best football with the Jets because it was he at quarterback that got them to the AFC Championship game against Denver. So, and that's how many years ago now? What, 18?
Yeah. Yeah, it's got to be. But yeah, I mean,
2001.
You know, we're going through a situation right now, like I mentioned with the Bills, where I don't even know. I haven't checked the injury report yet, but they brought in AJ McCarron to be the guy who was going to be the sort of veteran who is going to show the ropes to whatever quarterback they drafted, which of course ended up being Josh Allen. And AJ McCarron suffered a hairline fracture of his collarbone in the game on Friday, so. No telling how long he's going to be out, but it may very well be that that's a 4 to 6 week injury easily. So if he's not able to play through it, then that means that Josh Allen is going to have to start the season because Peterman is just miserable. And Allen, you know, he's the one that everybody said had all these accuracy problems, but he's put in a couple of pretty solid games against first or second team defenses. So we'll see.
Well, right now, I think with the Jets, they're trying to figure out who will be the quarterback.
Yeah.
So, we'll see. We have a few weeks to go. We'll have to sweat it out and just keep watching baseball for now.
Yes. Yes, indeed. So, what else has been tripping your trigger this week?
Well, I do want to talk about a new release because it's by somebody you and I both like. This review appeared on MusicTap.net, and it's the new album from Nick Piunti.
Oh, nice.
Temporary High, which is absolutely fantastic. It really is. It's another release on Gem Records, Marty Scott's Gem label. And let me see if I can put this the right way. But remember when we went and reviewed Trust Your Instincts back in 2016, you know, it was that kind of Michigan power pop that is completely indicative of that area.
Yep.
It's got that garaginess and that riff heavy thing, but this one is just so tight and so clean and so filled with melody, layered with hooks, layered with riffs, layered with textures. It's like this is his moment. You know, this is the album of his career as far as I'm concerned. And it's been a pretty lengthy career. You know, it's not just power pop. It's riff rock. It's garage rock. You know, it's everything you would expect to hear if we were driving down a road in another decade and able to hear these songs on the radio where they belong.
Yeah.
There's a track called Keep Me Guessing, which to me it's the album standout. It kind of made me think of the DBs and the Birds because he uses a lot of 12-string Rickenbacker on this album, which of course you and I both love.
Yes, indeed.
A lot of it took, I think, bits and pieces from Big Stars in Space, which is the album nobody ever talks about. It was the 2009 album with, 2004 album with John and Ken from the Posies, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's got this wonderful cascading riff, and it sounds like a cross between Petty and McGuinn type of vocals.
Which again, tend to sound pretty good layered over a 12-string Rick.
Exactly. It's almost too natural for its own good.
Yeah.
Frankly. So it just, that's an idea of how good this record really is. You know, because to me, it's a case of if you overanalyze an album, it takes away the desire to actually check it out. So all I can say is there's your taster, there's your prime. We've talked about Nick Piunti in the past. And he's delivered an album, like I said, that's the album of his career. It's out now. It's available. It's called Temporary High. And you really ought to check this out. The review is up there right now on musictap.net. Read the review. Check out the album. There's music on there by all means. And then work your way back through his catalog because it's well worth the time and effort.
Yeah, that I can vouch for, definitely. And I'll be listening to the new stuff this week. I wish I had some more new music to throw at you, but I have heard nothing. It has been a desolate wasteland for me for the past 7 days as far as new music is concerned. But the one thing we did do just a couple of hours ago, so I'm still in that period of time where when a movie really makes you think about something, you have to spend some time just letting it sort of settle just a bit. But I will say this, we went and saw Spike Lee's latest, Black Klansman. And if you don't know the story, it's based on a true story of a guy who was with the Colorado Springs Police Department back in the 1970s and decided to use his voice on the phone to infiltrate the Klan. And the movie is outstanding. It was just an incredible piece of work, and I won't spoil it, so relax. There's no spoiler alert or anything, but uses some connections to current events, especially at the very end of the movie, to sort of update the fact, as I think we're all aware, that some of the things that they were afraid of enough in the 1970s coming about have in fact come about. So I'll leave it at that and just tell you the acting is outstanding. The story is incredibly well told. And if this one does not earn him some kind of awards consideration, it will be a crime because frankly, there hasn't been a whole heck of a lot at the movies this year to get excited about.
Now, carrying on with what you just said, last night we watched or attempted to watch, depending on your point of view, last year's big Academy Award winner, Darkest Hour.
Mm-hmm.
With all the accolades, you know, the fact that Gary Oldman won the Oscar, you figure, okay, this has to be good. It's a period piece. It's historic. It's fact-based. I have to admit, I found it to be disappointing and tedious.
Really?
It just lacked anything. Now, I hate to make the comparison, but the last time I saw a movie that was in this vein was The King's Speech, which was absolutely magnificent.
Yep.
You know, it hit every possible right note, but Darkest Hour was so flat. It would have been better served to just watch an actual documentary that would have been more interesting. Seeing Gary Oldman as Churchill was not particularly awe-inspiring.
Yeah,
you know, I'm sorry to say I'm sorely disappointed by it.
Yeah, I was.
And that's the short of it.
I was a little bit. I was in that same boat with you and thinking, okay, this needs to be a little less. I mean, the pace of it was terrible. But what I was also surprised by is that the character development that they did, what little there was with some of the ancillary characters, didn't amount to anything. Nobody came back at the end of the movie to become a part of the story again. It was like, why are you here? Why am I paying this much attention to you in the first 25 minutes if you're just going to sort of fade out of the movie?
Right. And that was a little bit too much of the same thing in this movie. It was like seeing Ben Mendelsohn for all of like 5 minutes and that's it.
Right.
That's a waste of good talent.
Yep.
You know?
Right.
It just didn't resonate with me.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact that you said you brought up the pacing, that was exactly what I had said last night. It's just, it just plods along. Mm-hmm. So, okay, you know, on we go.
Right. And Black Klansman moved incredibly well. And what you said about the King's Speech, you know, the magic to me of that movie is taking the King of friggin' England and making him relatable. You know what I mean? Everybody kind of felt for him and was rooting for it. It's like, oh, that poor dude. He's the King of England. You know, that poor dude. But yeah, you really did. You felt for him. And that was, you know, with this movie, very different, obviously very different time, very different story. But everybody in it had some kind of relatability to either somebody that you know and can't stand or somebody that you know and really like. And I'll tell you, I saw Spike Lee talking with Trevor Noah on The Daily Show, talking about this movie. And he said, you know, I'm hearing stories from people where they'll say, you know, black people in the audience will go out of the movie and white people will walk up to them and hug them or shake their hands or just, you know, and I could feel that because the audience where we went was about half and half. It was mixed about half and half. And it was, you know, I definitely could get why that would happen because it's not, I mean, I'm sure you're going to hear a lot of, you know, a lot of racist assholes whining about white guilt. That's not the point of this movie. It really, really isn't. You know, it's a document of those times and these times and saying, okay, what has changed? And it's an important piece. I can't imagine anybody that wouldn't be able to take something out of the movie.
Well, that's the whole thing. Relatability and a takeaway.
Yep.
And right now, maybe it's just me, but I don't remember the last time I saw a movie where I gave even the slightest damn about the main character.
Right. Right. The other thing about Black Klansman is it that kind of surprised me a little bit is it's very funny. And I know Spike Lee has a great sense of humor, but it's got its moments where everybody is cracking up in the theater. So be ready for that as well. It certainly has plenty of things to make you really angry, but it's also it doesn't take itself so seriously that it can't tell a good joke.
Well, I got a good joke for you. Speaking of which, because we like to do comedy on this show. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Donald Trump.
Donald Trump who?
President of the United States. Thank you. Be here all week.
Oh, man. And for of all things, I mean, yeah, he's in the middle of another tweet storm, and it's all a bunch of crap anyway. But for him to start comparing this fake witch hunt to McCarthyism, for the man who followed and sniffed the ass of Roy Cohn for 30 years to start saying, this is just like McCarthyism. You know what? You used to hang out with those guys, Donald. You might want to back off of that one. Take 10 to 15% off of that.
Well, what about Rudy Giuliani's, you know, moment of triumph today, just proving the fact that he has truly gone off the deep end? Facts are not facts.
Right. Well, you know, which again shows we have not evolved one bit since the first day of this administration when it was Kellyanne Conwoman and her famous quote about alternative facts. Well, you know, if you can believe that those exist, then what Rudy said is true.
Then at what point does the media, because this is so much their fault and their irresponsibility, at what point do the media finally get a backbone again?
Right.
Well, and buck against it and tear it down and start presenting the facts and contradicting these presentations, because they're obviously not facts or alternative facts.
Yeah. Well, and in the same vein, they'll sit there and scream about the fact that nobody ever apologizes. None of these people ever say they're sorry for the things they do wrong. Did I miss the apology from Joe Scarborough about the fact that we're in this boat to begin with? Because I don't remember him apologizing.
I'm sorry, did you say Joe Scarborough? Wasn't he a Republican once upon a time?
Yeah. You know,
just, all of one term,
uh-huh.
A two-year term. Beating the drum that he was part of that that revolution that helped to shut down the government under what's his name? Oh my God!
Oh, Gingrich.
Yeah, you know, and how they fought against Clinton, and all of a sudden this media cuckold has been so roundly beaten by his girlfriend, Mika Brzezinski,
uh-huh.
Who's about as bright as a small appliance bulb. I'm sorry. That was a show I used to watch religiously. I really invested a lot of time and faith in things that they used to have to say. But they are so much a part of why Donald Trump ascended as well as he did, because they had him on that show almost every day.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And no apology. No apology for the fact that he made him a political star. He took him from being a reality show star and made him a political star. And he owes us an apology for that. And he won't do it. Now, on the subject of MSNBC, by the way, going back to what we had talked about earlier on with Aretha Franklin, while everybody's been banging away at Fox News for the Patti LaBelle fiasco, on Thursday, I happen to be listening to MSNBC in the afternoon. Is it Ali Velshi that they have on? Is he their afternoon guy?
I stopped watching MSNBC.
Okay,
seriously.
All right, yeah.
That's how much I dislike them now.
The only time I'll flip over to them, because I'm Sirius in the car, and I wanted to check in, and CNN was on another one of those stinking 1-877 Cars for Kids commercials, and I'm going to batter those people to death one of these days, too.
I want to hit the kids with a car.
But so I flipped over to MSNBC, and they said, oh, you know, coming up, we're going to have a big tribute to Aretha Franklin, and they had, I don't know, 5 or 6 guests on, and one of the last ones they said is, you know, we're going to have a chat just ahead over the phone with Marvis Staples. I almost drove off the road. Marvis. Look, if you don't know the woman's name, just why are you doing this interview, you schmuck?
Because that's all they have are schmucks on that screen.
I know, so bad. And that one doesn't get any press, but still, it's as much, it's as egregious an error.
You know, I got, you know, I've got no time for MSNBC. These are also the people that made Rachel Maddow.
Uh-huh.
Doyen of the left.
Right.
I have nothing to say beyond that.
No, but, you know, again, all props to Robert Mueller, because while all of this is going on and while this crap storm of them, you know, Giuliani on TV every day saying, we demand that he bring this to a close. Well, you can sit there and demand all you want. Demand in one hand and shit in the other and see which one fills up first. So while all that's going on, Mueller's saying nothing and just going out and doing his job. And, you know, we'll see what happens with the Manafort jury. I think they're probably going to come back either tomorrow, Monday, or maybe Tuesday at the latest. We can talk about that a little bit in a second. But, yeah, I just think, you know, I give the guy props, because in a government that leaks like a sieve, he has given us nothing. And you know what? I couldn't be happier about it.
Well, it's about time that somebody came up being stone-faced about the whole thing and keeping their mouths shut.
Yeah, he's got a job to do. I'm going to do my job. Leave me alone. Exactly. Yeah.
You know, but it goes back to what you and I talked about with people lauding Comey. Comey's the one that helped this get to where it is.
Right.
Don't give me that jazz about what a good guy he is, or he felt conflicted. Nonsense. He inserted himself at a time that he had no business doing so.
Right.
That was all planned. So do not come to me with that righteousness that you so easily, you know, glom onto.
Yeah. And, you know, the one thing that I wish that they would do is, you know, when they do those White House press briefings, you don't even need Donald Trump in the room. All you have to do is say, look, all weekend long, he's been tweeting about how Mueller's investigation is compromised and Mueller is subject of a conflict of interest and Mueller's doing this and Mueller's doing that. And the fact is that the Mueller investigative team has leaked nothing. We don't know what they're doing. We don't know what evidence they have. All we know are the names of the people that they've interviewed. So somebody needs to ask Sarah fucking Handlebars, what is it exactly that he thinks Robert Mueller has done wrong?
Well, you're not going to get an answer.
Right. But,
period.
But put it out there. Put it out to ask the question. You
but
know?
You know, it's going to happen. You ask the question, it's going to get deflected. Now, granted, the question needs to be asked, but you know how they obfuscate every single thing that is said and or asked of them.
Right.
But, you know, if you were to ask her directly, how are you today? She's going to get into an argument.
Yeah, true enough. True enough. But, you know, when the bombshell hits, it's going to be devastating. And it's always the one you don't see coming. And I think at this point, they see it coming. They know. They know. Based on who he's talked to, they know what he has on them, and it's scaring them shitless.
Well, I'll tell you what's made me feel really good this week. Notice it's another kind of feel-good week.
Yeah, yeah.
That's made me feel good this week in the political circle is seeing John Dean really sticking it to Donald Trump.
I know. Yeah, he's fun.
No, it's like he said, you know, Trump will, you know, at least Nixon knew when to get out. Trump will not do that.
No.
Trump does not have the dignity nor the integrity.
No, and I'll tell you, that is going to make it a lot harder for Mike Pence to act in the Jerry Ford role. Because if Pence is clean in this, and I don't know, I don't have any reason to believe he wouldn't be, but if Pence is clean in this and Trump takes the country through what everybody was afraid Watergate was going to turn into and gets forced out of office kicking and screaming, how is Pence going to turn around and pardon him?
Well, that's – let's burn that bridge when we get to
– Right. Right. So that said, we can leave the world of politics politics. We can leave the world of politics behind for just
political
a little
women. While. But the thing with the Manafort trial, I'll just say this much. It's taking too long for my liking.
Yeah.
It doesn't take that long to come back and say guilty on all charges.
Yeah. The only thing
it's so obvious.
If it goes beyond Tuesday, I'll be on board with that. The thing is, there are 18 counts for them to go through. And my worry is, especially given the fact that they late on Friday, they asked for a clarification on reasonable doubt. And everybody's trying to read something into that. what I think is going on there is you got one holdout, maybe two. There's not very many of them, but there's a small group that is playing the Trump routine and stamping their feet because they just don't want to put this guy away. And so the other jurors are saying, look, we'll get the judge to clarify reasonable doubt because what you're saying isn't reasonable. And, we'll kind of move on from there. But still, it's just an awful lot of paperwork to go through. So yeah, it doesn't surprise me that it's taken this long so far. Starts to get beyond Tuesday, though, that's when I get worried.
Yeah, well, let us hope that they convict him.
Indeed. Well, you ready to get on our heads a little bit?
I am absolutely ready to get out of my head.
All right. Well, good, because I had something happen this week, and I love it, these sort of serendipitous things, because I made a crack about a part of town here that is a very, very buttoned-up, frou-frou part of town, and they're having a blues festival today, which just makes me giggle, because I'm thinking, okay, yeah, Clayton knows a lot about the blues. Everybody there drives BMWs and has their guacamole delivered. So obviously they've got the blues. But just to be a jerk, I posted a snotty little post on Facebook about them. And then I thought, I can see it in my head. I start to see this thing happening where it's the most generic blues in the entire world. And every song starts with that famous line, "I got the blues so bad." So I Googled that line to see how many songs it actually showed up in. And I found a guy I had never heard of before who had a song called "I Got the Blues So Bad," but he was a legit blues musician dating back to the 1930s. A guy by the name of Robert Pete Williams, and I had never heard his name before, but when I started listening to him play, I was blown back. It was very much in that Robert Johnson sort of jumpy guitar style, brilliant stuff. I mean, the two-part harmonies that he was getting out of that fretboard, I think it's tuned to an open G, but I'm not positive about that. But it was so right and so on point, and the lyrics were great.
"Did Dr. Walk there? Boy, what wrong with you?
And I thought, this is exactly what nobody walking through Clayton, Missouri would ever understand, as I was looking through, the first thing that stuck out is he was born in 1914 and died in 1980. So he's been gone now for, 38 years? And I've had that happen so many times over the course of my life where I'll start digging into somebody and, have something just land on my desk, or when I was a kid, just I'd hear something on the radio and start listening to it. Honestly, I did not become a huge fan of Harry Nilsson until after he was already dead. It's like a bittersweet thing. It's like, wow, there's this incredible body of material out there, but I know going in, I'm never going to hear anything new from this guy because he's been dead for a long time. So, I'm still going to do it because it's great music, but I started going through that list of people that, Jimi Hendrix died, all three of them. I mean, Janis, Jimmy, and Jim all died within a year of my birth. So I really never had a chance to know them as living artists. And of the three of them, Jimi Hendrix is the one that really speaks the most to me. But I know that there are those musicians that still produce new stuff well into their 60s, 70s, and sometimes even their 80s that's worth listening to. It's rare, but it does happen. But still, who are those names that to you have become a big part of your musical life that by the time you even knew they existed, they were already dead?
That's a hard one, actually. It's a good one and a hard one. Let me just preface what I may say by, when you brought up that scenario of these, ultra white folks in the suburbs and the blues, I immediately flashed to that scene in the movie Ghost World.
Yes.
You know what I'm about to say. You know, Blues Hammer.
Right.
Okay. I would have to say that just about every musical entity that's had meaning to me.
Yeah.
They were all alive in one form or another when I got into them and died on the way. I was never a fan of Hendrix. Let's put it that way.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I like the singles, basically. So I've never been a big Hendrix fan, nor a Joplin fan, nor a Doors fan. Mm-hmm. We had that conversation. I grew up in a very pop oriented household, so everything was on at all times, and my mother would buy records on a weekly basis.
It's all the new stuff, yeah.
Yeah, so like Harry Nilsson was part of the records that she'd buy, or John Denver, or she bought me something, anything by Todd Rundgren, when it came out, even though he's not dead. He's dead to me at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So they've all been alive, and somewhere in my musical gene pool.
Yeah.
Now, to work my way backwards into a deeper context, Big Star was there because I knew about them because someone had said that we reminded them of Big Star. I didn't know who Big Star were. And this is going back to the mid 80s when their records weren't available and the name wasn't mentioned. And the phrase was, well, you like the DBs, don't you? And you're influenced by the DBs. Well, the DBs were influenced by Big Star.
Right.
And that's how, it wasn't until a serendipitous moment in 2012 that the whole reblossoming, if you will, or true blossoming of my fully blown Big Star obsessions really took hold, and it was only because I don't know what made me do it. I think it was out of boredom from listening to everything that I'd been listening to on my iPod, frankly.
Yeah.
I decided to listen to Number One Record, and I thought, it might be cool to get a Big Star t-shirt. And when I'd come home, and I sat down at the computer and I said to Liz, because she said to me, what are you doing? And I said, I'm looking for a Big Star t-shirt. She said, funny that you should bring up Big Star. I was just reading about how there's a Kickstarter campaign to do a movie about them, a documentary. And I was like, well, what's Kickstarter? And she said, well, she explained to me what Kickstarter was and I understood right away. And I said, well, let's see what they have to offer. And that was it, really. It reconvened a liking of the band to the point where I could not not listen to them every single day.
Yeah.
Of course, at this point, Alex Chilton, Andy Hummel, and of course Chris Bell were long gone. As a kid, I grew up listening to Elvis Presley. Right. Elvis was a favorite in the house. The day he died, our vacation up in Cooperstown came to an end because my mother was so upset by the news. I was in a swimming pool when it came over the radio.
Yeah.
I didn't
find out about it because I was 7, I think, almost 8 years old.
Shut up.
Sorry.
Age card with me, Sonny.
No, but I mean, the way that I heard about it, because I did have a friend in school who was a very big Elvis fan, even at that young age. And so I saw the National Enquirer, the picture of him lying in the coffin. And that was what brought it home to me. I was out, mom was grocery shopping, and I saw that and learned that Elvis had died. So, yeah.
Yeah, I was 15 when Lennon died. And, I was upset over it in the context of, the Beatles were now officially never going to be able to get back together. But I was never a Lennon fan, and it didn't make me go back and become a Lennon fan.
Right, right. And with me, I knew of Led Zeppelin, and I had some appreciation for what they had done when John Bonham died, which was just within a month or two, right? Because Lennon died on December 8th, 1980, and John Bonham died September 25th, I want to say, 1980. So, I kind of had some vague notion of what was going on, but again, I was 11. So, later on, by the time I really got into them, which was about 4 or 5 years later, then it was already, I'm never going to hear new music from them as an entity, But of course, Jimmy Page was still making records. Robert Plant was still making records. John Paul Jones was doing movie soundtracks. They were out there and producing. I'll tell you another one that I was four when he died, so obviously didn't have any real connection with it until much later on, was Jim Croce.
That, I was just about to say that the first time I can consciously remember something like this was Jim Croce's death.
Yeah.
In September 1973.
Yep.
And I had already been a fan. You know, I had You Don't Mess Around With Jim. I had Life and Times, and I had I Got a Name. And, you know, to hear that he had died in a plane crash on WABC radio, you know, that morning before school was just completely upsetting.
Yeah.
So that was the first time that I really felt the impact of something like that. The next time it really hit home was we were in the car on our way to – it's funny. It was on our way to Music Center in Newdorp, which is the about 15 minutes from where we lived in Eltingville. This is all in Staten Island because Music Center always had the new releases first. And I was on my way to pick up the newly released Who Are You because I hadn't had a chance to get it yet.
Yeah.
And I was what, in seventh grade, eighth grade? It was the start of eighth grade. When we heard on WNEW that Keith Moon had, in fact, died.
Yep. But see,
my brother looked at me like completely mortified.
Right,
so.
Right. And with me, it was kind of the same thing. Keith Moon doesn't make it into that list of people who were gone before I appreciated them because Tommy was in my dad's Camaro from the time I can remember, you know? So, yeah, I always knew what the Who was all about. And there was a whole bunch of stuff that he used to play of theirs. And so that was part of the soundtrack of my life.
Because of the age thing, I think it's, and because of the household that I grew up in, you know, I was always made aware, you know, consciously or unconsciously of all these different musical influences that are still with me, you know, part of my, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
They've all been dying in the span of my lifetime when I am conscious.
Right, right. But I mean, you know, Mississippi John Hurt was dead years before I was born. And so, you know, coming into that music later on. And a lot of it is old blues guys who were born in the teens and the 20s. But still, you know, there was very much an active Bo Diddley while I was alive. There was very much an active B.B. King while I was alive. So, yeah, you know, you knew that those guys were still able to produce stuff.
I'm going to have to retract one. Otis Redding.
Oh, yes. There you go.
I was over two when he died.
Yep.
So, but the thing is, his records were always in my house.
Yep.
So it's not like it was never a presence.
Right.
You know, that I had to backtrack. It's just that, okay, he died when you were a baby. Kind of thing.
Yeah. But yeah, it does make for a different experience when you know?
Yeah. And, I don't know, I guess in that respect, I've been very, very lucky. I mean, it's lousy to watch your heroes start expiring. But again, you know, going back to what we said at the very start of the show, that's all part of life. You know, it's the circle of life itself.
There you go. And the circle of the culture, you know, as well. Well,
to wake up, you know, the day before my birthday and hear that David or the day after my birthday and hear that David Bowie had died was
right.
A very, very weird thing, you know, because A, it was so unexpected, and B, you know, it was also his age made, you know, it's funny that we're living in an era when people in their 60s and 70s are thought now to be too young when they go.
Right. Right.
When we were growing up, 60s and 70s was usually when people were dying.
Yeah. Well, and of course, I mean, there's all of the guys from the day the music died as well. Neither one of us was alive when Buddy Holly was making records. So same thing with Ritchie Valens. But yeah, if you take anything from this, go check out this guy, Robert Pete Williams. I think you're going to find a lot of stuff you're going to really dig.
And you know what? Let's give a plug to Jim Croce, because even though he had three albums, those were three majestic albums, and he was quite a singer and songwriter.
Yeah, what a storyteller.
I'm not the same. Can you blame me? Is it hard to understand? I can't forget. You can't change me. I am not that kind of man. Don't you know I had a dream last night? Everything was still. You were by my side, so soft and warm.
He just never gets enough credit where it's due. He's one of those artists that people tend to always go, oh, yeah, I hate that.
Right.
I don't blame them. I just hate that because it's the afterthought mentality.
Yeah. And that's, if there's anything that, that is really truly missing from music now, it's people who can do that, who can spin that kind of a yarn that just gets you interested in the story, gets you into what's going on in the song. And on top of that, it's a nice song with a good hook and all of that. I mean, that, what a skill. What an incredible skill.
Yeah. And that's a skill that is sorely, sorely lacking right now in music. Tomorrow night is the overhyped MTV Music Video Awards. First of all, that no one ever watches. They haven't been relevant in, well, they've never really been relevant, but I am completely, and I say thankfully, devoid of any knowledge of what any of these things sound like, look like, or who almost every one of these people are. I have never heard of them. They have the stupidest names. They, the, what they quote offer is for the lowest common denominator. What passes itself right now for popular music is simply for even further dumbing down an already ignorant generation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's more than insulting. And the other thing that I found interesting is that when you watch all the nominees and so on and so forth, it's blah, 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 featuring blah, blah, blah. None of these are just an effort by somebody.
Right.
You know, they need assistance because they all lack talent and of their own merits.
This is going to go off on a weird tangent, but because of what you just said, there was another thing that occurred to me along those lines, and maybe we can expand on this next time we talk, which is we heard Magic Man in the car last night on the way back from our concert. And Heart, to me, my dad's a big Heart fan. My mom was a big Heart fan. I appreciate it. I think Ann Wilson's voice is incredible, and I think a lot of the music was really well put together. It wasn't quite my wheelhouse. So Magic Man is one of those songs that the thing I find the most interesting about it is the guitar break. There's that dramatic pause in a song, and then the guitar is what fills the gap. I like that. And I heard it, and I thought, you know, I need to find out what that guitar was. Because it sounds like a Les Paul, but if you told me it was a Telecaster, I would buy it. Turns out it was a Les Paul. But in going down the rabbit hole and sort of following the through line, I found out something really interesting about Barracuda, because that's the one that probably is the best documented use of what they were doing in the studio in terms of who was playing what instruments, in terms of what effects were used, in terms of that bizarre flange sound on the guitar that nobody can, you know, nobody's been able to replicate. It turns out there's a reason for that. It was a kit. That flanger was a kit that he got from a company in Massachusetts that doesn't exist anymore and hasn't since then. Believe it or not, it was a company called Phoenix Technology, and they were just a little one-off, and they used to send out these kits for making interesting, you know, effects and grooves and things like that, and they had this rack mount flanger, and he got one and used it on Barracuda and a couple of other Heart songs, and that's, you know, that's why you can never quite get it right, because you need one of those. So In the thing about Barracuda, there was an interview about the sound at the close to the end of the song when it's nothing but guitar just sort of fading out, and there's those weird kind of lasery sounds over top. And they ask him what that was. And as it turns out, it was that flanger in combination with the fact that something had fallen behind an amp stack, you know, a thing of picks or something like that had fallen down. And he went to lean over the amp with the guitar on him, and it was going through that flanger, and the sound just started to come out of the speaker. So the producer was like, hey, holy shit, do that again. We need to record that. And they layered it into the end of Barracuda. That kind of innovation, that studio magic, that's the kind of thing that because there's very little instrumentation in what's on MTV, you'll never see that happen again. Those happy accidents, that serendipity that causes the magic to happen, it's gone.
Well, let me just cap it by saying this. What you're talking about is actual music, music making, performance,
right.
Playing an instrument, writing a song, having an ensemble to actually work on this with a producer who's trying to do something a little different and make you stand out a bit. All this is a bunch of foul-mouthed imbeciles who have absolutely zero – they're uneducated buffoons. They're all vile individuals, and they know nothing about – how to make music.
Yeah.
Any moron, and I'm using the word moron because I'm being diplomatic here, can use one of these stupid and very cheesy sounding rhythm machines now, come up with a stupid beat, and put some obscene lyrics over it. Isn't that impressive?
But you know, they can say their own names a lot in a song.
Well, that's because the only thing they do is love to tout how wonderful they are.
Yeah, one of these days I'm going to do a count. I'm going to find out who has said their own name the most in a song, and then we'll kind of go from there.
That's a good idea. Look it up and get back to me on that one.
All right, brother.
Meantime, though, I'll tell you what. If nothing else, MTV does have one ace in the hall, and that's this Thursday night. It's round two of Jersey Shore Family Vacation, part two. Yeah, buddy.
Enjoy that's yourself.
I am looking forward to.
All right, man.
Sad statement, but hey, you know, we all need our purple passions.
You got it. Enjoy it and have a wonderful week, and we'll get together and do it all again next time.
You better believe it, brother. You take care and stay well. I'll talk to you soon.